so this is just a stop. So everything has been great today except for the weather. I've been complaining to everybody that I've been cold. It's been warmer in Edmonton, and I'm certainly going to a warmer place in Atlanta. But what I'd like to do today is talk about the spatiotemporal dynamics of nuclear proteins. And so I'm looking at proteins that live in the nucleus of a cell. And I actually would like to talk about two different problems. Before I do that, actually, the two people who have helped tremendously on this project are Gustavo Carreiro, is my PhD student, who's actually just moved into the lab of Michael Hensel. And Michael Hensel is an experimentalist working in the Department of Oncology at the Cross Cancer Institute. And he's the one who actually proposed the project. And certainly without talking to him, nothing would have gotten started. And so I'd like to talk about two different problems. They're somewhat related, and the first one has to do with modeling the mobility of nuclear proteins. And you'll see that this is really serving as a warm-up problem to the second one. And when I say warm-up problem, it really was a problem that got us started in talking to Michael Hensel, and while we learned more about the biology that was involved. After that, we were able to then go on to the second modeling problem, which is, I think, mathematically a little bit more interesting, or I'm hoping that you'll also find that more interesting, and that's on the spatial organization of nuclear proteins, and it's talking about the architecture of proteins within the nucleus. So I'll start off by explaining what FRAP is, and this is really getting into the first modeling problem. So FRAP stands for fluorescence recovery after photobleaching. So this is an experimental technique that Michael Hensel uses pretty much on a daily basis in his lab. And it's to study how fast proteins are moving within the nucleus. And so the proteins that he wants to study are tagged with something called green fluorescent protein. And by tagging with a green fluorescent protein, the way you can think about this is that the proteins that are being studied are basically tagged with headlights. They're basically little headlights that are attached to it. And so you cannot see the individual proteins moving around in the nucleus, but you can see the field lit up when these proteins are tagged. And then the fluorescent proteins are photobleached within a small region of the nucleus. And by that we mean that there's a laser beam that is pointed at a small region in the nucleus. And that laser beam removes the fluorescence from the proteins that are being hit. And so if you're only photobleaching a small area of the nucleus, immediately after photobleaching, that area would be dark because all of those proteins have their headlights turned off, so to speak. But the way to think about this now is that these proteins are all still moving around. So the ones that have their headlights turned off are starting to move into the other regions of the nucleus. The ones that still have their lights on, that weren't hit by the photobleaching, are starting to move back in to the region that was hit by the laser beam. So as that occurs, as time progresses, you'll eventually start to recover the fluorescence in the region that you photobleached earlier. So because of the diffusional exchange between the bleached and the unbleached proteins. Okay. Yeah. No, that's a very good question. So the function of the proteins is maintained. So it's just the way we're thinking about it is very much that just the lights are turned off, but the function is exactly the same. They're moving around in exactly the same way. Yeah. Or that's maybe a little bit hard to tell, but there's a dark band right here. Okay. So I should actually also point out that this is the nucleus of the cell. So this is the entire cell, and this area here is the nucleus. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So the fluorescence is actually totaled up over the region that has been photobleached, and then the experimentalist could send us a data set that looks like this. So it's very much, here's the fluorescent intensity. It's all been normalized back to one. as a function of time, and so the fluorescence eventually recovers back to 1. It depends a little bit on how you normalize, but I don't really want to get into that detail. And so, of course, depending on how fast these proteins are moving, the recovery of the fluorescence is either faster or slower, depending on whether the proteins are moving fast or slow. So you can get a recovery curve that looks like this or that looks like that. So qualitatively, they look the same, but quantitatively, there's a difference there. And so... Yeah, totaled over the over this region here that was photobleached. That's right. So this will bring me to a point later on is actually that the experimentalists essentially get rid of the spatial information, right? And we're going to take advantage of that later on as well. Okay, so the question that the experimentalists have is, from the fluorescence recovery data that we get, how does one deduce information about the mobility of the proteins? How fast are they moving? And essentially what they were looking at for a long time is just the diffusion coefficient, just some effective diffusion coefficient. But the experimentalist that we're working with, Michael Hensel, is not very happy with that, with just an effective diffusion coefficient. He would like more. Okay, so historically, what have people been doing? Well, they've just assumed that the proteins are diffusing only. And so you can solve the diffusion equation. This has been done on an infinite domain, which is actually also quite interesting because, we're working with a nucleus that has very much a boundary, but the boundary has been ignored completely in historical approaches. And then... And it's also, that is actually a simplification that I made in making this slide. And so you can obtain the solution of that, and then you're just integrating over the photobleached area, and then you're just integrating over space. You're ending up with some function of time, and that is then fit to the data. And so you can obtain an effective diffusion coefficient. And so this is the kind of graph that you would get from that kind of an approach. So indeed, you do get an effective diffusion coefficient out of that, but you can see that the fits are not all that satisfactory. So the diffusion model does not provide satisfactory fits, mostly because the proteins are doing more in the nucleus than just diffusing. They're actually having a function. And so what we're thinking is that the proteins also have interactions with other structures in the nucleus. And so that temporarily will hold them up. Okay. And so we're going to build some new models, nothing particularly more sophisticated than the diffusion model, but something a little bit more sophisticated, basically the next step in this entire process. And so we're going to assume that proteins undergo a reversible binding process with a structure that is assumed to be immobile. And we're assuming that that structure is present throughout the nucleus. And the unbound proteins are indeed free to diffuse. And we're also going to assume for the time being that the profile of the photobleaching is just a very narrow band through the nucleus so that we can reduce the problem to one dimension. And so one can write down a very simple reaction diffusion model. And so we basically are keeping track of two species of fluorescent molecules, the ones that are free to diffuse and the ones that are bound. Okay, so U are the ones that are free to diffuse and V are the ones that are bound.
What is the
We're assuming that there's some nuclear matrix, although that is a bit of a controversial topic. But we're assuming that there's something unspecified that the molecules can bind to. And so we have a binding term and an unbinding term. So these ones were the ones that were free to diffuse, and so they're moving into the bound population by this term, and they're moving back into the free population with this term over here. So, and here we are going to actually impose some boundary conditions, which are no-flux boundary conditions. And you can also solve that analytically, and so then the theoretical fluorescence recovery curve is just the sum of the bound and the unbound fluorescent molecules integrated over the appropriate region. And again, we get some function of time. And when we fit that function to the data, we get actually three model parameters. We get the unbinding and the binding rates, as well as the diffusion coefficients. And so this is the kind of thing that we get. So this was the original fit to a set of data with just the diffusion equation, and here is the fit with the reaction diffusion model. And so, of course, it looks more like what we would expect. And so the way that we're interpreting this is that what we actually see here are two phases. We have a very fast diffusion phase. So this recovery is due to the free molecules that are moving around in the nucleus. And then there's a slow turnover phase. And the reason that this is slow is you basically have to wait for the bound molecules to become free before they can participate in the recovery process. So we get some numbers for the model parameters, D, K sub B, and K sub U, and we can interpret them the following way, that the proportion of molecules that are in bound form is about 0.16, and the proportion that is free to diffuse is about 0.84. And so the physiologists were actually quite interested in seeing these particular numbers. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And of course, so then the numbers are actually dependent on the model. Somehow, right? But my claim is that this is better than just diffusion, right? And exactly. So that's right. So it's a nice compromise, is what you're saying, right? It's just having three rather than. Yeah. You had a question as well? Oh, that's a good question. We haven't done that, but that is something we should look into, right? In whether there's other ways to model the diffusion. Yeah. Right. No, that's absolutely true, and that's something that is we want to look at in the future. Yeah. And another is a slow, and so that's also a very good question. So the question is whether the data is consistent with having two populations, a population that is moving slowly and a population that's moving fast. Yes, and the answer is it could. But in this particular case, we don't believe so. So we've played around with that, and we can't quite get as good a fit as with what we're doing at the moment. And the question is also, how big do those proteins have to be? And we think that they have to be too big in order to fit the data nicely.
What the biologist said, according to the biologist paradigm, there's only one type of protein, so there are many types.
So we're only looking at one particular species of the protein being studied, right? So we haven't tagged all the proteins in the nucleus.
One
type of protein, exactly. Yeah. That are moving very, very slowly, right? On the time scale of the experiment, essentially they're not moving. Exactly. That's another way to think about that structure. Yeah. Okay, so one of the questions that we had about this is that, so the experimentalists basically get rid of space, right? So they just give us time-dependent data, and we said, well, we don't really need the complication of a partial differential equation. We should really be able to do all of this with a compartmental model. And so our physical space is this here. So this is the nucleus. This is the region here that's being photobleached, and these are the two parts of the nucleus that are not being photobleached. And then in each of these physical compartments, we again divide the population of proteins into fluorescent and non-fluorescent proteins. And so these are the ones that are not fluorescent. I'm confusing myself here. Sorry, bound and unbound proteins. So these are the ones that are unbound. And they can move freely between compartments, between the physical compartments. And then we have the binding and the unbinding as well. Okay, so these ones here are the bound compartments. And so here we have, it looks like we might have four parameters, but it turns out there's really only three because D1 and D2, because of the symmetry in the system, what we're actually going to do is we're going to add them up, and we're just going to deal with a transfer diffusion coefficient, essentially. And so we're still looking at a system with three parameters, and because, this just turns out to be a very linear system, six differential equations. And so we can obtain the solution very easily. And so now the recovery curve is just the sum of U0 and V0, and we just get an exponential curve. And this is something that the experimentalists like a lot because they don't have to actually deal with fitting a solution to a diffusion equation. They can just deal with an exponential. And so these parameters, alpha, beta, and gamma, can actually, they're known expressions of these parameters, the unknown ones, k sub u, and d sub t. So again, we can get fits, and we get exactly the same kind of thing. This was the fit with just the diffusion equation, and here is the fit with the compartmental model. And so the results that we're getting for the parameters are very comparable to what we got for the diffusion equation. Okay. So a few questions that we started investigating here is, well, first of all, also, what is the relationship between the reaction diffusion model and this compartmental model that we had, which is something I don't really, I'm not going to talk about over here. But one other question that I'll touch upon very quickly here is the two types of limiting behavior that you can observe in these models. And that is reduced diffusive behavior and biphasic behavior. So we're really we've done a perturbation analysis of these models and looked at, well, what happens if the binding and unbinding rates are both very fast, or what if they're both very slow? And those are the two limiting types of behavior that are interesting. So if they're both large, so if there's a very rapid turnover between bound and unbound proteins, then the reaction diffusion equation just reduces down to a diffusion equation, but with a reduced diffusion coefficient. So this is the actual diffusion coefficient, but it appears to be smaller with a factor of 1 plus k. Then there's another kind of behavior, and that is this what leads to the slow turnover, and that is if both binding and unbinding coefficients are both small. So in that case, you can write down an inner solution and an outer solution in the language of perturbation theory. And so the inner solution corresponds to the fast diffusion phase, and the outer solution corresponds to the slow turnover phase. Okay. So as I mentioned before, this was really just a warm-up problem for us to get talking to the biologist and to understand what TRAP was all about and things like that. Okay, so let me conclude this warm-up problem right here. And the main message really is that the simple diffusion model does not provide a good fit for all FRAP experiments. And so if you start making a few obvious changes, or maybe not so obvious, if you make some changes to the model and you include a reversible binding process, you can in fact do a lot better. And then some limiting types of behavior as well, the reduced diffusive behavior and the biphasic behavior. Okay. So let me go on to the second problem that I would like to talk about. And this is about the spatial organization of the nuclear proteins, or really a question that deals with the architecture of the proteins in the nucleus. And so this picture here is a small details. The idea is that you don't need to know the small details of that particular picture. I just want to talk about a very specific protein, namely a splicing factor. And a splicing factor is a protein that is found in the nucleus of the cell. And it moves randomly throughout the nucleus. And it helps in the transcription process. So it takes out introns or non-coding sequences from the messenger RNA before it is transported to the cytoplasm of the cell. And so that's really what this picture is showing you. You've got a piece of messenger RNA. There's a piece of non-coding, or there's a non-coding sequence in there that needs to be taken away, and it's the splicing factor that helps in doing that, and taking that non-coding sequence out and ending up with a piece of messenger RNA that then will go out to the cytoplasm. So that's just a function of the splicing factors, but exactly what they do is actually not important for the modeling that we're going to be doing. Now, what's very interesting about these splicing factor compartments is when you do these FRAP experiments, what you very often see are these clusters. So again, here is this is the nucleus of the cell, and so the splicing factors here have been made visible through the green fluorescent protein. And what you see is that they're not homogeneously distributed throughout the nucleus. In fact, there are these clusters where there is a lot of fluorescence. And so we're assuming that there are many splicing factors are aggregated right in that particular spot. Now, this is something that you'll see during the interphase of the cell cycle. And so you can think of the cell cycle, you have an interphase, and then you have a mitotic phase. And during the interphase of the cell cycle, that's when you see these clusters. During mitosis, when the cell is dividing, these splicing factor compartments actually disappear. Okay? And so the question that we want to take a look at is, what is the mechanism that is responsible for the formation of these splicing factor compartments, the maintenance, and their disassembly? And so splicing factor compartment sometimes is also called a speckle, and I'll probably use both words interchangeably. And so what I'd like to take a look at is, first of all, what are some of the biological hypotheses that have been put forward to explain what's happening here? And then we'll translate these biological hypotheses into a model and do some analysis. Basically, we're going to be looking for pattern formation, and then I'll conclude that with some predictions that the model is making, and also some words about future experiments. So there are two hypotheses. The first hypothesis has to do with self-organization of the splicing factors. So it turns out that splicing factors are in continuous flux between the splicing factor compartments and the nucleoplasm itself. And so what you need to know about splicing factors is that they exist in phosphorylated and dephosphorylated form. And what that means is that a phosphorylated form is that there's phosphate groups added to the proteins. So here are the proteins in unphosphorylated form, and here they are in phosphorylated form. They've just got a phosphate group added to them. It turns out that increased phosphorylation, so phosphorylation means adding a phosphate group, promotes the release of splicing factors from the speckles. So phosphorylation, you're adding the phosphate group, and then the splicing factors do not like to hang out together. If you have the process of dephosphorylation, you're taking away the phosphate group, and dephosphorylated proteins like to interact. There's a region on the splicing factors that then like to interact with each other. And so that underlies the making of these splicing factor compartments. So increased dephosphorylation is required for the formation of the splicing factors. So that's going in this direction. As I said before already, the dephosphorylated splicing factors, they are the ones that like to interact, and the phosphorylated ones do not. Okay. But there's something else going on here that we would like to add to the model, and that is the existence of this nuclear scaffold that I was talking about before as well in the context of the first modeling problem. We're assuming that the splicing factors, again, are binding and unbinding to some underlying structure. And exactly what that underlying structure is again, it's a little bit of a controversy, but I would say that 90% or maybe even more of the biologists do believe that there is this underlying structure. It hasn't been exactly identified yet. Okay, so we're going to assume that these splicing factors can bind to this underlying nuclear scaffold, and that the interaction somehow occurs at the same time as this binding, because we don't want to have proteins that are just interacting with each other and then just have two proteins moving together and then maybe a third one adding on. It's basically once they interact, they stop moving, is what our assumption is going to be. So here's the model skeleton for what I'm going to be describing here. So we have, again, two species of proteins. And this is different than what we had before. So it's not bound and unbound. It's phosphorylated and unphosphorylated splicing factors. Okay, so U is unphosphorylated. They're the ones that like to interact. V are the phosphorylated ones, the ones that do not like to interact. And so the ones that do not like to interact, we just have a very simple diffusion equation, and then we can we have a phosphorylation and dephosphorylation process in these last two terms over here. So they're moving back and forth between the two compartments, essentially. And then the unphosphorylated splicing factors, well, there's something more interesting going on there, right? So these ones are moving around, but they're also interacting. And so the question is, how should we represent that motion and self-interaction term? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to flesh out that motion and self-interaction term in the next few slides. Okay. And so the two parameters that I want to draw attention to as well, because I'm going to look at them again towards the end of this talk, are this delta, which is the dephosphorylation rate, and the rho, which is the phosphorylation rate. Right? So how fast the phosphate groups are added or taken away. Just the fact that we need to start somewhere, and so we're just looking at pattern formation on a line, and we're assuming that if we do indeed see pattern formation, that the same phenomenon will carry over to two dimensions, and it's okay. So we don't actually need to look in three dimensions because the experiments are often done on cells that are attached to slides, and so the cells are in fact almost two dimensional. But we're just going to look at it on a one-dimensional, just to see whether we can get pattern formation in the first place. Yeah. Come on. Okay. So to derive the motion and self-interaction term, we're going to consider a random walk. And so we're looking at a protein that is sitting at position X, and we're looking at spatial intervals of size lambda, and we're looking at time intervals of tau. And we're going to ask the question, in a time interval of size tau, what is the probability that the particle or the molecule is going to move to the left a distance of lambda, or moving to the right a distance of lambda, or staying in the position where it is at the moment? Okay, so L and R are the probability that the molecule that is located at position X at the moment and time T moves one unit to the left or the right. And N is the probability of staying, which is N1 minus the probability of moving to the left minus the probability of moving to the right. No, it's just some fixed time interval. And so if you do this diffusion approximation, you get the following Fokker-Planck equation. And so we have a mobility term over here and a bias term where the mobility mu and the bias beta are expressed in terms of the probabilities that I had on the previous slide, the L, the R, and the N. And so we're going to assume that R is equal to L. So moving to the left or moving to the right, that probability is the same. And so, in other words, there's no bias in our movement, and so this term here goes away. We just have this mobility term to worry about. And in order to figure out what that mobility term is, we need to figure out what N is. So we're basically going to create, we have to do a little bit more modeling. We're now going to flesh out what that probability N should be. Okay, and this is where the self-interaction is going to come into play. So the probability N, we're going to assume that depends on the number of bound unphosphorylated splicing factors that are in the neighborhood of the molecule itself. And so we're basically going to be counting up the number of unphosphorylated splicing factors in this small neighborhood around a molecule, and the small neighborhood is going to have a psi sigma. Okay, so we have a kernel function that's very simple. We just have this step function. So we're only going to be counting up the molecules that are sitting in this small neighborhood of the molecule. And then we have some, so there are actually two parameters here, but they don't need to be two parameters. There actually only needs to be one of them, which is really the, so we can forget about omega, don't worry about that. But we have this kappa here, which really measures the aggregate of sensitivity. How likely is it now, based on the population of neighbors, how likely is it now for the molecule to actually stay? That's based on experiments, that the unphosphorylated ones like to interact with each other. Yeah. Right. They don't like each other. That's right. Or the unphosphorylated ones, right. The unphosphorylated ones and the phosphorylated ones, there's no interaction as far as we know. Yeah. Okay. So we had the general Fokker-Planck equation without the bias term. So we just had this mobility term where mu was equal to d times 1 minus n. We've now figured out what n is. And so we could leave it as an integral differential we could leave it like that, but we don't want to do that. I'm actually going to use the Taylor expansion for you, and then only keeping the first few terms in that expansion, so neglecting all order s to the fourth terms. And then you end up with this lovely PDE term. Now, I understand there's a number of you in the audience who know way more about PDEs than I do. And so maybe you say, oh, wow, that's really cool. I'm hoping that's what you'll say, and that we can have a chat about that term after. But in any case, this is why I thought this term needed a little bit of fleshing out, right? If you just see that term, it's like, wow, there are a lot of details there. Okay, so let's summarize where we are at the moment. So here was the model skeleton that I had introduced before. This motion and self-interaction term is exactly the term that I ended up with in the previous slide. So it's this term over here. Okay. And so now we have this model where unphosphorylated and phosphorylated proteins are interacting with each other. But it's a bit much to actually analyze this all together. As a matter of fact, what I first want to do, I want to say, well, what happens in the absence of phosphorylated proteins? So let's get rid of the V equation for the time being. So we'll get rid of these two terms as well. Let's just worry about what are the unphosphorylated proteins doing by themselves? Can that equation by itself lead to pattern formation? Okay, so I'm going to take a look at just the equation for you, and here this has been shown in non-dimensionalized form. Okay, so there's really only one parameter left to worry about, and that is that sigma. Okay. And so the question now is can that equation lead to pattern formation? So what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, any constant density is a uniform steady state of that particular equation, and so what I'm going to ask is whether that steady state is stable or unstable. So the question really is under what conditions does this equation exhibit pattern formation? So under what conditions is the uniform steady state unstable? So unstable steady states are going to be equated with pattern formation. So you can linearize the partial differential equation about the uniform steady state, and you end up with this linear equation for capital U, where capital U is the deviation from the uniform steady state. And then if we study the normal mode solution of the following form, then what we're looking for in order for the steady state to be unstable, we want lambda to be positive. So that's what we're looking for. Lambda being negative would mean that the deviation goes back to zero, which means that the steady state is stable. So when you plug that into the equation, then you end up with something called the dispersion relation. And the dispersion relation basically summarizes the relationship between the growth rate lambda and the wave number q. Okay. And so if we always have these lambdas, the growth rate lambdas, if we always have them negative, then the steady state, uniform steady state is stable. If it is positive for some of the wave numbers, then we can get pattern formation. Okay. So it turns out that if the uniform steady state is less than 1, then it is always a stable steady state. And when it is greater than 1, then some of the modes will give positive growth rate lambda, and so in that case we have an unstable steady state. Now, actually, if we interpret this biologically, right away we have a conclusion, namely that we have to have enough molecules in the system in order to get pattern formation, which kind of makes sense, right? Because this is the assumption here is that we have an interaction between the proteins, so there need to be enough proteins in the first place to be able to interact with each other in order to get pattern formation. And then in general, the fastest growing mode determines what the spatial pattern actually is. Okay, so here are some numerical simulations to back up what we just found, is that if you take the uniform steady state to be 0.9, and you start off with a random initial condition, so that the green dots here, and you let time progress, you'll eventually end up with the uniform steady state at 0.9. If you use 1.1 instead, so we're now sitting above, we're sitting in the regime where you have pattern formation, then indeed you let time progress and you do indeed see some pattern formation. So here's the density as a function of space. And so we're assuming here that if there's a high density, that is indeed what forms the splicing factor compartment or the speckle. So one of the questions that we can certainly ask at this point is, what is the effect of changing sigma, which was this detection range for the molecules? And so you would imagine, yeah? Oh, the green points are the initial condition, and the blue curve is after some time. So this one here, is the blue solution is at time t, and this here the blue solution is at 0.25. Yes? Yeah. The solution for the entire equation. Yeah, so the dominant mode is it's whatever the dominant mode is determines actually how many peaks you're going to have. It is representative of the dominant mode, exactly. Yes. Yeah. So what is the effect of changing sigma? And you would imagine that if you decrease sigma, so if you decrease the detection mode detection range of the molecules, you would expect to have smaller speckles or smaller splicing factor compartments. And you can look at the dispersion relation and see what happens if you change sigma. And indeed, if you're decreasing sigma, so if you're making this detection range smaller, then the wave numbers that are associated with the unstable modes are larger, meaning smaller wavelength. And so numerical simulations also verify that. So here, going from left to right, we have smaller values of sigma, so smaller detection ranges, and we do indeed end up with more and smaller speckles or more and smaller splicing factor compartments. And the sigma is in here. Sigma is equal to 0 would not be a good thing. No, but if sigma is 0, then the problem is not well posed. So we stay away. Okay, there. Okay, so that's where that's basically what the equation gives us for just U, and now we're interested in, what if we bring the phosphorylated population back into the equation? And so now I'm going to study the full system with the phosphorylated proteins back in. They're just diffusing, and then there's this phosphorylation-dephosphorylation process tagged on to the end of the equation. And so it's not surprising to find that these equations also exhibit pattern formation. And so you can again make pictures of the dispersion relation, but you get the same kind of thing. You also get pattern formation, provided that, again, you have enough splicing factors floating around or moving around in the nucleus. But the question that I want to focus on is how does the dephosphorylation parameter delta influence the compartmentalization? Of course, you could ask exactly the same question about the phosphorylation parameter rho, right? But the effect will exactly be opposite. So I'll just do one of them. And so here's a diagram that takes a little bit of explanation. So we're going to be looking at UV space. And we're going to assume that we have a fixed amount of proteins in the nucleus. So we're going to assume that U plus V is equal to 2. And so that means that any steady state or any uniform steady state has to lie on this line. It also turns out that the steady states have to lie on this line where U and V are related with delta over rho. Okay. So it's basically the intersection of those two lines where the steady state is going to occur. And now we're going to ask a question, is that a stable steady state or is it an unstable stable steady state? And so we're going to change the parameter delta. So if you change the parameter delta, you're changing the slope of this line over here. So if you're increasing delta, this line over here will increase like that, right? So as you're increasing your delta, your steady state is basically moving along that line. And now we're asking, at what point does the steady state become unstable? And so if delta is small enough, for example, if delta is equal to 1, the steady state, the uniform steady state is stable. If we move delta to 1.1, it's already unstable. So somewhere between delta equal to 1 and delta equal to 1.1, the steady state becomes unstable. And so we find that for small values of delta, there's no compartmentalization, but for large values of delta, there is. And of course, you can find exactly where that bifurcation occurs. Before I show you where the bifurcation occurs, here are some more numerical simulations. And so what I'm showing here is here's U as a function of space. Again, the green dots are the initial condition. The blue curve is after some time. This is when delta is equal to 1, so we were expecting no pattern there. When delta is equal to 1.1, we were expecting a pattern, and that's indeed what we're seeing. And this here is what V is doing at the same time. So V also goes to a uniform steady state in the first case, and it's not quite a uniform steady state. There's also some pattern in V. Okay, so here's that bifurcation that I was talking about before. For small delta, you've got stability. For large delta, you've got instability. Okay. But this is only for if you have two. U plus V is equal to 2, but of course you can ask exactly the same question for different amounts of biomolecules in the system. And so if you do that, you end up with these bifurcation diagrams. Here are all these different U plus V totals. And so for every one of these red lines, you can ask the same question, and for every one of those red lines, you can make one of these purple dots. And so you can divide the space up into a stable region and an unstable region. And depending on what the value of rho is, that magenta line is not always a straight line. It could look like that curved line. Okay. So the bifurcation diagram over here is a little bit unconventional in that it is in UV space, but we can translate that into rho delta space, which are really the two parameters that we're interested in. And so certainly, dephosphorylation was good. Lots of dephosphorylation makes the splicing factor compartments in the experimental situation. And in our model, it does the same thing. If for any fixed value of rho, if you increase the dephosphorylation or the delta parameter, you go from the stable regime into the unstable regime. And the difference between this picture and this picture is that the total number of biomolecules has decreased. And so if the total number of biomolecules decreases, the stable regime is larger than it was over here. So that's also, that's a prediction in a sense of the model, right? Okay, so here are some of the predictions spelled out. So the formation of splicing factor compartments is in fact or is indeed enhanced by increased dephosphorylation or an increased number of splicing factors. The number of splicing factors increases as the range of the detection sigma decreases. Now, this is something that we find a rather interesting prediction of the model, but we're not so sure that this can, in fact, be tested in the lab. It's not it's not clear to me how you would change the detection range of the molecules. So that is a prediction that we might never be able to test. Whereas the first one is something that likely could be tested, assuming that the biologist can, in fact, tweak the number of the population of molecules in the nucleus. And another prediction that comes from this: if you take the underlying nuclear scaffold away, so if the aggregated sensitivity is equal to zero, that was the kappa that we had earlier, then it turns out then the equation collapses just to a diffusion equation, and so then no splicing factor compartments are formed at all. Okay, so. What's associated with mitosis is decreased dephosphorylation or increased phosphorylation. So we actually think that the compartments are destroyed because the rho and the delta are undergoing some sort of an oscillation. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Some concluding remarks is that this is actually the very first model that addresses the question of architecture in the nucleus. It supports the hypothesis. We're not saying that this is the only model. As a matter of fact, the paper has just been published, and we're hoping for some feedback from experimentalists as well as other theoreticians. And what we're hoping is that this is kind of like a springboard for more sophisticated models in the future, that and maybe even alternative hypotheses that are translated into biology, so that we can really have a better basis for comparing the different hypotheses. The dynamic behavior of the model is consistent with the biological observations. The cycle of phosphorylation and dephosphorylation modulates the aggregation of splicing factors. So Mary, this is the question that you were asking about. So this is what is thought to underlie the difference between the interphase and the mitotic phase. And so we're hoping to design some experiments to determine parameter values, such as the dephosphorylation rate and the phosphorylation rate, neither of which are known, and test more of the predictions of the model. And so this is exactly what Gustavo has is planning to do during his postdoctoral work with Michael Hensel. So just an additional word about Gustavo. So Gustavo started as a pure mathematician, came into our department and retooled himself as an applied mathematician, and now actually is very interested in doing theoretical support in the experimental lab. So that is where he is at the moment. He's got a desk in the lab and is very much involved, first of all, in writing some software to do the parameter estimation, and then also doing more theoretical support along the lines of this kind of modeling. And I'd like to leave it there.